Okay, good morning. Thank you very much for the introduction. So this talk is called Beyond Compassionate Release, Health-Based Advocacy in the Jail System. I just wanted to, since Ross and I will be sharing the presentation, I just wanted to thank, at the beginning, the Dr. Ross McDonald and Homer Venters for their support, Allison Jordan and her team for helping us gather some extra data and putting the presentation together, and then Dr. Zach Rosner, who's back in New York. We have no disclosures. So the objectives of this presentation are going to be to first describe compassionate release and its historic application in the prison system. We're going to describe differences between prisons and jails that are relevant to health-based advocacy. We're going to describe briefly our study that sought to better understand the nature and value of health-based advocacy in the jail system. And lastly, we're going to suggest some next steps to optimize the court's ability to provide safe, effective sentencing options for detained patients. So, as many of you may know, compassionate release is a form of health-based advocacy. It's a process by which seriously ill individuals are allowed to die in the community prior to completing their sentence. And it was established under the premise that changes in health status may alter justification for incarceration. Specifically, the four justifications for incarceration being retribution, rehabilitation, deterrence, and incapacitance. And it's historically been employed in the prison system for individuals with established sentences. Individuals granted compassionate release are then usually sent to medically appropriate settings, such as nursing homes, hospice facilities, occasionally home hospice. But it has many challenges associated with it. Specifically, it's very late stage. It's very time intensive on the behalf of attorneys and social workers and everybody involved. And it's often unsuccessful in the prison system. Some 2008 data showed that three out of the 399 deaths that year in the federal prison, only 27 were ultimately approved for compassionate release, and many ended up having pending cases at the time of death. We work at Rikers, and so one of our questions was really, how do we think about this issue in the context of the jail system, and how is the prison system different from the jail system? So, Rikers is a big facility. It therefore has a lot of people that could be affected by some form of health-based advocacy. But it's really less well-defined in the literature. Jails, because of the transience of the population, are poorly equipped to care for for seriously ill and dying patients. There's great flux in and out, a lot of folks that are in jail are awaiting trial and sentencing, and patients with serious illness, medical or physical, are often unable to fully participate in the court proceedings. And so there's a lot of opportunity for health-based advocacy. So our initial study was really to better understand the nature and value of health-based advocacy in the jail setting. And what we sought to do was we looked at letters written by Dr. McDonald, the medical director for Rikers Island jail system in New York City, from 2010 to 2013. And we looked at letters that he was asked to write on behalf of individuals who were currently in the court system. And we looked at these letters, we had IRB approval, we de-identified the letters, and then we reviewed and categorized them according to the presumed objective of the letter and the primary disease process that was noted. It's a bit of a busy slide here, but we basically created categories for presumed objective of the letter, and this was the first category was compassionate release, and that was for people where the letter explicitly said this is to support an application for compassionate release. Those words were used. We have a large percentage of the letters that we categorized simply as not compassionate release, and those were letters that were just describing complicated or complex medical problems that were affecting an individual who is currently awaiting trial and sentencing, but it was really unclear what the medical information was going to be used for. 28% of the letters were to support an application for alternative to incarceration, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. And then 5% described catastrophic illness that happened while the patient was in jail. An example of that was somebody suffered a massive hemorrhagic stroke while in jail and was completely incapacitated. And so what we found on review of these letters was the vast majority of the letters were not actually to support applications for compassionate release. Only 22%, in fact, were. 78% of the letters were actually supporting other forms of health-based advocacy that were taking place on behalf of individuals in the jail system. So our preliminary findings based on that small study was that medical information is clearly relevant, but like I said, the vast majority of the letters were not formal applications for compassionate release. There's a spectrum of severity in both disease states and charges that must be considered in the jail setting that's different than in the prison system. And the nature and scope of the information deemed relevant to the courts necessarily differs between a jail and a prison population. So I'm just going to turn over the presentation now to Dr. McDonald, who's going to discuss a little bit about the transitional healthcare coordination work.
Thank you. Let me introduce Dr. McDonald. Dr. McDonald is the medical director of the Bureau of Correctional Health Services for the New York Department of Health and Hygiene. He earned a BS in biology and English from Cornell University in Ithaca and an MD from Weill Medical College of Cornell University in New York City. He completed his residency in social internal medicine at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx, New York. Dr. McDonald has specialized training experience in substance abuse treatment, medical evaluation of survivors of torture, women's health, clinical epidemiology, and global health. Dr. McDonald's interest in the incarcerated as a vulnerable population dates back to his time teaching English literature in a maximum security prison in upstate New York. He helped found the Montefiore Transitions Clinic for the recently incarcerated, and prior to working at the Department of Health, maintained a patient panel enriched in formerly incarcerated patients. He has made multiple presentations at national conferences on topics related to incarceration and health. In his role as medical director of the Bureau of Correctional Health Services for the New York City Department of Health and Hygiene, Dr. McDonald oversees medical care provided in the New York City jail system, the second largest in the country with over 60,000 admissions per year. 11,000 average daily population, and 1,000 healthcare staff. He's also responsible for formulation and application of policy on a wide range of medical conditions, oversight of the jail-based opiate treatment program, quality improvement, resident teaching, and direct patient care. Recent and cultural projects, current projects include improving transgender care, injury surveillance and epidemiology, defining health consequences of solitary confinement, and expanding access to opiate replacement therapy. I'll give you over to Dr. McDonald.
Wow. Thank you, Diane. Goodness. And thanks, John. That was great. So I just really want to point out that the work that we've just described is really just the tip of the iceberg. So that all occurs on the backdrop of a tremendous amount of health-based advocacy that happens every day in our system, and really it happens under the umbrella of Transitional Healthcare Coordination, or THCC, and under the umbrella of Linkage to Care. So this work really comes from the perspective that jail is a harmful place for people, and that the less time they spend there, the better. So how can we, as quickly as possible come up with a plan for our patients to return to the community in a way in which their medical and mental health needs are addressed, and often also their more fundamental social determinants of health are addressed, such as housing, clothing, shelter. So this is really the work of transitional healthcare coordination, and the letters that we write and that we just described are the tip of the iceberg for the sort of work that goes on. And much of it doesn't require our intervention as physicians in any way. So there's a tremendous amount of linkage to alternatives to incarceration programs, which come in many flavors. So there are drug treatment programs, mental health treatment programs, vocational training programs, and I would even include things like more structured environments than where the patients came from to begin with, such as HIV nursing homes. And a lot of our role in facilitating these linkages is logistics. So it may be as simple as providing the health records to the programs who require psychosocial assessments or other documentation, which in the context of large bureaucracies is crucial work. So if it takes 2 weeks for a usual application for a medical record, in our setting that delay might mean that somebody stays in jail for 2 weeks longer, which we consider to be an unacceptable additional risk to their health. The other bucket of work is compassionate release. It's hard to define. I think that's kind of part of the point of the talk, is that we don't know exactly what compassionate release means. We know what it means in prison systems, where it's defined more robustly in law, and there's a very high standard required to sort of overturn a sentence that somebody's currently serving. But in our system, as John described, it's something much more fluid. And oftentimes we don't know if what we're doing is actually compassionate release. So we defined it as when we use those words. But even the decision to use those words or not is probably fairly arbitrary. And in some cases, in retrospect, had wished I had for patients who, sometimes these efforts are not successful and patients are sentenced to die in jail. So the impetus for compassionate release or this type of work or these types of letters comes from many sources. Oftentimes, transitional healthcare coordination staff are contacted directly by attorneys, judges, occasionally prosecutors, maybe. Oftentimes they come from patients, oftentimes they come from physicians working in the system, as well as physicians involved in oversight of the medical care provided in the jails. So they can start from lots of different places, but they come through a common pathway of transitional healthcare coordination, and we really look to them to guide us, and by the time we write a letter, it's usually what they want us to write. And much of it doesn't require our intervention, as I mentioned. So this, as compared to the relatively small number of letters, is a snapshot of what CHS has done in the year of 2014. So you see that most of the work, 433 cases, involved alternatives to incarceration. And then a smaller but still significant number of people where we were pursuing compassionate release or sentence reduction. And the use of the letters was almost evenly split between the two and was required in the minority of cases. So another question is, when are we doing this work? So this slide represents a continuum for our patients as they enter our system. Most of what we do and what we oversee is this part of the process. Arrest and pre-arraignment are a period of time that might take 72 hours. 48 to 72 hours, generally speaking, in our system. But it's an important period of time because it really determines if somebody's going to go back to the community that in that moment or if they're going to go to jail. And when they go to jail, they're generally there for weeks to months. So the median length of stay in our system is 7 days. And for many of the patients with complex medical and mental health needs, we think that that length of stay is much longer than that. So it's really kind of a key turning point, the pre-arraignment setting. But we're really doing most of the work in the jail setting, so we're trying to minimize the amount of time that people are in jail, but they're already there, which maybe leads us to think that we could start to move this process earlier and earlier. So one of our crucial next steps is to think about how we can sort of insert ourselves into the pre-arraignment setting. We have devised a pilot to do just that. There are logistical challenges to that as well, including space and time. So when you have a very abbreviated process like that, where a lot of things have to get done, to try to do something fairly complex, like summarizing medical and mental health information for a court, could be untenable. But we also think we have ways to identify those people who might be candidates for this kind of work up front. So our electronic health record allows us to know who our patients are, and unfortunately the recidivism rate allows us to see them coming. So moving the process up would have several benefits, including expediting care within our own system, because that initial period of entry into jail is a high-risk time. But our goal would be to allow, really, in that process, the judge to take into consideration some of this medical or mental health information that is deemed to be relevant. We'd also are contemplating this bucket of work of really kind of trying to advocate for the patients who come back to us the most, and really to bring to the attention of the criminal justice system that they're essentially utilizing an intervention, which is incarceration, that for the individual at hand, it has not worked. So by the time somebody's been through our system 20 or 30 times within a space of 5 years, we know that those people have a certain have certain medical and mental health needs that are really not being addressed by incarceration. So whatever behavior the criminal justice system is attempting to modify, our message for that subset of patients is that it's not working. So this very expensive intervention of incarceration is not modifying any of the behaviors that they're trying to modify. And to think about identifying those people at the point of arrest and thinking about linking them to a different model. We also know that a large percentage of those patients are homeless, so it's really a question of what are the interventions that we would recommend, and supportive housing is at the top of the list. We're in the process of identifying whether those people have had access to supportive housing, though there have been really good supportive housing efforts in New York City. We think that this is really a population at the fringes that may not have found themselves targeted for those services. And then just as soon as possible to identify the seriously ill people who come to our system. You know, one of the challenges of this work, I think, is it's easy for us as physicians to write a compassionate release letter and, you know, to say, we as doctors say that this person should not be in jail. But if you think about why terminally ill people might end up in jail, it's really much more complicated than that. So really we've learned from our colleagues at THCC that the way to look at it is to start from where should this person be, where could this person be, other than here. Because it's probably whatever's going on in their life that led a terminally ill person to come to jail in the first place. And if we can really approach it from a social work first perspective and identify a plan where that person could be, and then approach the court with a cogent plan that might actually work, which is easier said than done because of the logistics involved with that, which I sometimes refer to as the social work Olympics. When we approach the courts with a cogent plan like that, our chances of success are so much higher in our experience, and the threshold for compassionate release starts to come down. So if you have a cogent plan for a person with just serious illness, it may not be terminal illness, it allows us to really advocate on that person's behalf to address whatever factors led them to come to jail in the first place. Thanks.
At this time, can the speakers come up? We can take questions from the audience at this time.
I skipped. Diana, can I just acknowledge Randy Sinnerite, who does a tremendous amount of this work? She really is an expert at knowing the criminal justice system and who to talk to. Lee Hain, who helped with the slides, sitting in the audience over there. And, of course, Allison Jordan, whose leadership we look to in all of this work. She oversees transitional healthcare coordination, and also Zach Rosner, who's holding down the fort in New York City.
Great support. Do we have any comments or questions from the audience? Question in the back.
Two questions. One is, I was curious, what is the range of criminal is the spectrum of severity of criminal charge. Because it's jail, we see a lot of people who are there for fairly low-level things. I think, you know, drug charges are the ones that come up the most in our experience. And
possession, mostly?
Well, we're not so sure. I think most of the time it's probably related to sale. Because there are cases where the possession cases kind of get disposed of by the court. So if you look at the 7-day median length of stay, possession cases kind of come in and go out on their own. So I think most of the ones by the time we're advocating on somebody's behalf with the court, they've been there for a decent amount of time, and there tend to be more serious drug charges, but they seem to be mostly drug charges.
Question on this side?
Sure.
Well, we have
the,
So thank you for the compliment. I think with incarceration, when I flashed the slide about the New York study, the first study of 8,000 people shelter users, there was a subgroup that had a lot of issues, mental health issues, and two or more barriers to employment, and one of those barriers was incarceration. And that there's also an overlap between people who have mental health issues being incarcerated or often jailed for minor offenses and then thrown out onto the streets. And I think I'm not a sociologist, so I don't draw those kinds of models with arrows, but I think that if I were, I'd draw one of those cycle models where you see, you know, jail, prison, street, shelter, lather, rinse, repeat. Mm-hmm. And that definitely, with the rise of the carceral state in the late 70s and 80s, became one component of homelessness. But really the rise of the carceral state is a little later. So it's like the late 70s and 80s, so people are being incarcerated. So right now you see a rise in homeless, like, formerly incarcerated people being homeless, in homelessness. In the 80s, there were other things going on that were predominant.
Okay, we'll take a question here.
Yeah, I think that we are probably at a very unique and important moment in the whole business of mass incarceration in the United States. Both liberal reformers and even conservatives have begun to feel that this is a costly, wasteful, useless system. I have, when the Soros Foundation gave the ACLU $50 million to lead a political campaign to reduce incarceration, they actually were praised by the Koch brothers. That you can't go further along the spectrum. So the point is, And the sense is what's driving this, obviously, is the huge cost of running these systems. How do you imagine that the nature of your work will begin to shift if the process of decarceration really takes hold and we begin to move back towards the level of incarceration that existed 25 or 30 years ago instead of these monstrosities?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think for those of us who came to the work because of the sociological phenomenon of mass incarceration, so we're drawn into it because we wanted to be part of it, really what would be, I think, a generational project, at least, to draw back what has occurred. You know, I think we dream about sort of drawing down. So we showed the slide with all those jails on Rikers Island. I'd like to see them close one by one. And there will still be, we'll still have patience always, that this work, you know, will not go away, because it really, in part, represents the safety net of last resort, even in a city that has a good social safety net. But I think
Yes, there's a question.
If I may say, it has a decrease in the federal system. I actually worked in the federal system and have done so for a long time, and the passionate belief experience that I've had working up in that arena has been quite lengthy, extremely lengthy. That's when you're a good group, that it takes so long to talk yes or no, to tell me yes or no, but you want to go to this person. Because they're there, we have them for a long time. We've done them for a long time. We know that they are. They're having a secret thing and they've gone to surgery and they're not doing well or they can't go to surgery and the like. So our experience is a little different in that we get feedback in people where they don't. You know, we know that. But also, my question to Pam about the homelessness situation is that now with the numbers, how is they varying? We find more homeless veterans. And what is your perspective on that? Or have you even looked at that aspect? Because the numbers seem to be increasing tremendously. We love that you're coming back. And they are in the permanent defense system. It's not okay to stay out. It's not okay to stay out. I'm hoping that this turns out. Because they're afraid that that will impact their enlistment or their service to the service. Mm-hmm. So if they get to a point where they are dismissed, or they get to a point where they come back, somebody said that's coming back from overseas, fighting the war, when they come back and they don't want to admit that, and then we have this growing community that we're observing, and many times the family is even again, both their homeless and so what are we doing about that? Or do you have any data?
I would say I'm not studying that, but I've heard quite a bit of it at conferences and that there's a concerted effort. I know that I'm living in Washington, I find that there's a concerted effort to at least talk about addressing this issue and the VA has prioritized in ending homelessness among veterans. But as you noted, there is a significant group that is not able to access VA services because they may have been discharged other than honorable discharge because of the repeated deployments and the PTSD. I've heard about that anecdotally, that's a hard group to reach because you can't get a HUD-VASH voucher for housing and people can't get into the system. I think that's something that isn't being addressed. But also you have the other population of veterans from the Vietnam era, and that group is for the first time, it seems like, effectively being reached, and the homelessness is being reduced among this group. But again, I mean, we have an issue of political will. Do we want to, do we have the political will to eliminate homelessness among veterans? It seems like there's some of that. Do we have the political will to eliminate homelessness altogether? I mean, we had the HPRP program, which was Homelessness Prevention and Rapid Rehousing, was funded under the stimulus, and from what I hear from people out in the field, it was amazingly effective, and then the funding has disappeared, and that was for homeless families, and including veteran families. So, do we have the political will to restore this, and can there be across-the-board support to create a safety net for people returning from multiple deployments and for anyone else who, reaches that crisis where they're out on the streets?
Question?
I actually don't have a question, but a good comment. You heard a very brilliant statement about the veterans. I'm working on a study right now which goes exactly to what you're saying on justice involved veterans. And what I'm seeing, we're looking at recidivism, and what we're seeing is homelessness, substance use, mental illness, all being impacted as the veterans reoffending. So it's not just mass incarceration, it's mass reincarceration. So I think all of these three things are what we have to work on, that the UAP and the homeless families affect all these programs. There's not a lot of veteran associated programs.
I had a two-part question for Haney. Yes, two parts. For the youth, what kind of marketing strategies are you implementing to reach the youth that are in need of services within your area? And of the ones that you can cater for, What's the success rate of having them return to their families?
Well, I should start off by saying that this was just a survey, so we have not implemented any marketing strategies. It was more of a needs assessment. But our recommendations are, because we know that homeless youth are so technology-driven and connected, just because they're homeless doesn't mean that they don't have Facebook or they don't have cell phones or are emailing regularly with people. So definitely recommending connecting caseworkers and other agency staff or healthcare providers to homeless youth via technology, so maybe even sending them Facebook messages or text messages reminding them of upcoming appointments. And then, I'm sorry, what was the second one? About reconnecting?
What is the success? Yeah.
Unfortunately, our study did not look at if you want to go back home or not. Mm.
Okay.
But there are previous studies. Norwegian Milburn did a large study a few years ago about newly homeless youth and reconnecting them to their families.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Are there questions? Yeah?
So I just wanted to first thank you all. This is awesome. And for representing the work that we do with such a cogent way so that others could understand it. And there's a big shout out. So if you're from New York City, to CHS, so working on it, just raise your hands. You know, you know that it really does take a village. And this is not Erica's raising hand because we couldn't do any of the money.
Mm-hmm.
And Homer for support and encouragement all the way. And also Dr. Lincoln, because we got the genesis of the idea of this as part of a SPINS demonstration project that was funded by Person for our interview positive clients. And it was just really an idea that Fortune Society came up with as a way to enhance our model of making grant funding. And so we didn't know it would work, and it did. We found a couple things. One is that in New York, because we have housing assistance and services for people with AIDS, we knew that we had housing for all of our HIV positive clients, and instead it was funded for folks living with HIV. When it comes to funding for folks who have other chronic health conditions and are other folks who are, I'd say, unstably housed, right? There's a whole variety of that I think you very eloquently described, but the issue of housing is always for us. We can't talk to anybody about where they're going to go to the doctor if they don't have a place to live. And so our ideal is a one-stop shop where we have, you know, housing, substance use treatment, mental health treatment, case management services, wraparound services, and a doctor in the house as an ideal way to help transition folks from jail to community. So whatever way and shape that you have to come, that's the other way. So I highly recommend it. And thanks again for that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I had a question for you.
Okay.
Does your group collaborate with any other state group so that what your successes are in New York can be transferred to another place?
So New York State has had challenges in releasing folks who are very ill. And in fact, there's some folks who stay in prison longer than their sentence because there is no place for them to go and they can't be released. So they're actually on conservative time, but they're still incarcerated. And we did help them. There was, I think, when Governor Cuomo came in, there was a list of 500 folks that were trying to get out, and we did help them with relationships, and I think we got a good about 100 folks off their list. So working collaboratively with them, and there's Lynn Patella at State Docs now, who's come to see us, wants to go look at the model. She brought this to the commissioner, so we're working with
them. Oh, very good. Thank you. Are there other questions from the audience? I want to thank our panelists today and the audience as well. It's been really wonderful to learn how much is going on in the city and around the nation to help these vulnerable populations. So I thank you. Have a great conference and have a wonderful day.
Thank you.